Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
You're back in the House of Mystery. It's KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm Al Warren. Kev Thompson is off for the week. Today we are talking with an incredible reporter. It's quite an honor to have him here. He's got a few books that are excellent books, and we're talking about the secrecy world today. And joining us is Jake Bernstein. Thank you for being here.
No, thanks for having me on.
So, this is a pleasure. How did you get into writing secrecy world? Like, what led you down that road? Because I'm guessing that this was a lot of, just from going through the book, this is a lot of work. This is a lot of research, a lot of contacts. And because I know what it's like to write a book, not like this. So I could imagine. So what made you take on such a big project?
Sure. It all begins with a phone call. I got a call from a friend of mine who was a senior editor at an organization called the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which is an amazing nonprofit that does collaborative journalism. They work with journalists, investigative reporters all over the world doing these big projects. And he said, you know, we're just beginning to work on something that I think you'll find really interesting, and I can't tell you anything about it on the phone. You're going to have to come to Washington, D.C. and meet with the director and the deputy director personally, and they will brief you. And so I went to D.C. and I met with Jared Ryle and his deputy, Marina Walker, and they told me that they had begun to receive these leaked documents. At the beginning, it wasn't that much, but it eventually turned into a torrent, and there were 11.5 million leaked documents. And they were coming from this Panamanian law firm called Mossack Fonseca, and they had already identified some really interesting things, including the Prime Minister of Iceland and people very close to Vladimir Putin and a lot of other interesting stuff. And they said, would you like to work on this project with us? And I immediately signed on. It was sort of a fascinating look into this secret world that very few people really know about. And so I spent a wonderful year working with more than 100 other journalists around the world and crackerjack investigative reporters from different countries on this project, sort of going through these documents and figuring out sort of the stories that they told and who were in the documents and things like that. And we sort of published our work, or began publishing our work, in April 2016. It was sort of a bombshell that was literally heard around the world. In fact, I spoke with both of the principals behind Mossack Fonseca, this law firm that had their documents, their database leaked. And Jürgen Mossack said to me that he really began to understand the enormity of what had happened to him and his firm when he turned on the TV and His life's work was literally on every single channel. So it was, for a while, it was sort of inescapable. But it was also fascinating to me, and I felt like there were parts of the story that we hadn't really been able to tell adequately. And one part was, in fact, the perspective of the two principal characters, Jürgen Mosek and Ramon Fonseca, what it was like from their perspective and how they saw things, and also sort of how the documents really showed the evolution of this secrecy world. And also, America's sort of central role in this story. And so a number of things like that. And I felt, I need to spend some more time here. There's interesting tales to be told. We really hadn't, even though we had spent a year, we had only scratched the surface of what these documents could tell us. And so I proposed this book and went off on another wonderful adventure.
Well, why? One thing that struck me is why so many people still have not heard about the Panama Papers and just the law group in Panama, just the whole thing. It's I'm talking to other news people and all this, and I mention it to them and they go, well, what's that? I'm surprised.
I mean, I think that's an excellent question on it. And it's part of the reason that I wrote Secrecy World. I think that Americans sort of think about this as something that happened somewhere else and that doesn't really have very much to do with them. The secrecy world is all about sort of place tax havens that are, tropical islands with ocean breezes and palm trees and things like that. It doesn't really relate to them. But in fact, it really does. First of all, the United States is probably the leading tax haven in the world. Delaware, Wyoming, Nevada pump out hundreds of thousands of anonymous shell companies. Delaware's pulling in $1 billion a year from its public registry. And the Treasury Department and the State Department have complained bitterly that Delaware's anonymous shell companies are being used by the Russian mafia and transnational gangs and other criminal elements to launder money. So it's a big problem from that perspective, but it's also a problem because, property prices in places like Seattle and Los Angeles and New York and Miami and San Antonio are really quite high. And part of the reason is that foreigners are using anonymous shell companies to come in and buy a property. And, that might be perfectly okay, but it also is being used for money laundering, for corrupt officials to park cash, and for other sort of nefarious reasons. And we can't tell the difference because it's very hard to get past who's behind these anonymous shell companies. And then finally, our government is complaining that it doesn't have enough money for infrastructure, for healthcare, for police. For education, for stuff like that, when, billions of dollars, more than $70 billion a year just from corporations, has been disappearing in these tax havens. So that was sort of part of the reason I wrote the book, is to bring it home to Americans and make them understand that, this secret, underground economy through its trillions of dollars flows affects all of us all the time.
Well, people nowadays, it seems like their focus is on, media sort of stuff, like the latest thing Donald Trump says, or whatever the case. They're more about the quick flash. And when they get a story like this, they can be outraged, but then the next thing that comes across their phone takes over. Like, this isn't going deep into people, and I don't know why. That's what's confusing to me. Do they just not understand what's happening here with the fake shell companies and what's really going on?
I think part of it is the fact that it is so secret. I mean, this is all by design, right? I mean, people are using this system of secret bank accounts and tax havens and anonymous shell companies and trusts and foundations. to hide their financial activities, to keep it out of view. And so that makes it very hard to see what is in fact happening. And that's why these leak investigations that the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists have done have been so important, because really for the first time they have given us sort of a macro view of how this world works and who the players are. Ultimately with the Panama Papers, more than 140 politicians from more than 50 countries were identified. There were more than 21 tax havens that were featured in the paper. So, we begin to see how prevalent this is, and that it's like an octopus. It's got tentacles everywhere. And I think the fact that it's been, something that happens underground, in this secret world, is a big part of the reason why it hasn't really penetrated the consciousness of most Americans.
So now maybe give a quick explanation of what and how people get away with creating shell companies, what they do, and how they can launder money. Like how's the little system go? So if you and I have a lot of money and money to kind of hide, what do we do?
Sure. I mean, that's a great question. First of all, we need to say that, it's not necessarily, it's not illegal to have a shell company, right? And there are legitimate reasons why one might want a shell company. Say you have business activities that you don't want your business partners to know about. That might be one reason to do it. Maybe you're worried about being kidnapped and you don't want the kidnappers to know, the full menu of your assets. Or maybe you're working in multiple jurisdictions and it just makes sense to base your activities in a jurisdiction that has low or no taxes. I mean, there's lots of different reasons, right? And that's all perfectly fine, right? But what's interesting is that since the publication of the Panama Papers, worldwide tax authorities have collected $500 million in unpaid taxes, right? So clearly the system is being used for tax evasion in a big way. And there's lots of different ways to do that. I mean, if you have money that you want to launder or that you don't want people knowing about, you could, say, set up an offshore company in the British Virgin Islands or in Panama or in Cyprus, someplace like that, and they could set up a bank account, and then you could get the money into the bank account, and the bank account could then, the offshore company could then buy an asset here, say an apartment or a car or something like that, and then lease it back to you. There's different sort of ways that you can play the system to sort of hide your activities, and the people who are really good at it, they layer their entities, right? So you don't just have an offshore shell company, you have a foundation and a trust. I mean, I have a, in the book, I actually talk about a Mexican gentleman who wanted to buy an apartment, a house actually, in Seattle for his sister. And the house was about $500,000. His sister was involved in a divorce at the time, and he didn't want the husband to find out about the house because he didn't want the house to be part of the divorce proceedings. So he set up a Delaware company, and the Delaware company was going to buy the house. But the problem is that he would be listed as the member, as the person who was behind the Delaware company. And so what Mossack Fonseca suggested was create a Panamanian foundation. We will put our employees as the people behind the foundation. The foundation will in turn own the company, which will in turn own the house. And so it'll be impossible to figure out exactly, who owns the house, because you'll end up at the foundation, and the foundation, the only people you'll see with the foundation will be these employees of Mossack Fonseca. So there's all kinds of reasons why you might do this. Some of it might be money laundering. I mean, the U.S. Treasury estimates that about $300 billion a year is laundered through the United States. And the U.N. thinks that it could be as much as $2 trillion laundered worldwide. So that's a lot of money, a lot of it's going through tax havens and secret bank accounts, and some of it's, you know, being laundered in other ways. It's being laundered through Bitcoin or things like that.
So we really don't have an idea of the amount that's really going on. Like we have an idea, but we could never really figure it out because they hide these. Like we can't, if you approached Panama or you approached a lot of these places that do this, they're not going to give us the information, are they?
This is precisely why the IRS has so much trouble, is that, these jurisdictions do not share their information. And so it's a real problem to sort of figure out what's going on. And yet, you know, President Obama said something quite interesting when the Panama Papers came out. He had a press conference and he was asked about this stuff. And he said, you know, we're never going to eliminate illicit finance altogether, right? It's always going to continue, but we shouldn't make it easy. And what's happened is it's really been made easy. And part of the reason it's been made easy is because the mega wealthy and corporations keep these highways of cash open because they use this system and they want the secrecy and they want the anonymity, you know, so that they can operate. But underneath that, you know, the criminals take advantage of it as well.
So, you know, with this whole system going on, it almost runs separately than who we put in as government. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, it is. there are powerful lobbies at work, right? So, for example, the Obama administration had a rule that they promulgated to try to make it harder for banks for anonymous shell companies to open accounts, right? The banks had to find out who the beneficial owner was, but the person who was actually behind the company. And it took several years for them to pass this rule. And in the end, what they end up passing is fairly watered down, and some people argue kind of worse than the status quo that existed. Well, why did that happen? It happened because the secretaries of state, you know, Secretary of State of Delaware and of Nevada and other places like that, lobbied fiercely, you know, to make sure that it was not a strong rule. And the lawyers lobbied to keep the, because they have an interest in keeping the system the way it is, and the bankers do as well, right? So there's a lot of vested interest here, and it, you're right, it transcends Democrats and Republicans. It's a function of how our political system works at the moment. And then the other thing that really, and I talk about in Secrecy World, my book, and the Panama Papers and the subsequent leak investigation, the Paradise Papers, really underscores is that there is a subset of the mega wealthy, you know, the truly, people who have $50 million or more, who increasingly don't see themselves tied to a specific country. You know, they'll have a house in London and they'll have a house in New York and they'll travel in on private jets and they'll send their kids to school abroad. And they might make money in the United States. They might be born here, but they don't have the same allegiance to the country that wealthy people in the past might have, right? It's almost like a transnational oligarchy. And they use this system. You know, they are the principal beneficiaries of this system. And that's changed, with growing inequality and the fact that the system has become so prevalent is kind of new, I think.
So what's going to come of this? that's a pretty big question, but where do you see this heading now?
I think it's a really good question, and one of the things that you see in Secrecy World and in the Panama Papers, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book is because the Mossack Fonseca started in the mid-1980s, but there are actually companies that are much older than that in the data, and you can see over decades how this system has evolved It's almost like a living organism, right? I mean, it sort of mutates to fight off efforts to rein it in and to continue how it operates. So I think that's happening now. I mean, I think that because of the bad press as a result of these leak investigations, some jurisdictions. Like the BVI or Jersey or other places like that are sort of upping up, increasing their vetting, their due diligence, demanding more information about the ultimate beneficial owners behind these entities, and so you see things moving a little bit more to places that are more opaque, like Dubai or Singapore, stuff like that, you know, jurisdictions like that. The other thing is that what Mossack Fonseca was trying to do was kind of be McDonald's of the offshore system, right? Their business model was high volume, low cost, which made perfect sense when they started in the mid-1980s, because really all you needed to do was you created an anonymous shell company. You didn't ask too many questions about who was the beneficial owner of it or what it was being used for. And then you just put the piece of paper in a file and you forgot about it for a year until it was time to invoice the lawyer or whoever had set it up, you know, to renew the company. But increasingly, there was more due diligence and more vetting that was required, and it became more expensive to do. And so this idea of being high volume, low cost kind of broke down a little bit. And increasingly, we're seeing that this system is the bar to entry is higher. So it's not the merely rich who can use the system efficiently. It's the uber wealthy. And so I think that's another change that has happened over time.
So the law group in Panama, the Mossack Fonseca, they started with just, like you explained that in the book, they really started with nothing, two guys, and turned it into a huge operation. What do you know about those two guys, and what was special about them that helped them create such a system?
Boy, that's a good question. I mean, part of it was timing, right? Which is, I mean, every business success story to some degree is timing, right? And they hit a time when there was, you know, new wealth in the developing world in places like Brazil and China, and they just hit that perfectly. And it was also because of computerization and things like that, it was possible to do a business at this scale. But the other part of it was, in fact, what you put your finger on, which is these two guys were kind of exceptional, right? Jürgen Mossack is a fascinating character. His father was literally a Nazi. He was a member of the SS in the Hitler Youth. And after the war, he's actually captured by U.S. intelligence, and they try to turn him, perhaps, to rat on his fellow ex-SS members. And eventually, his father moves the family to Panama, and Jürgen is a young boy. He doesn't speak any English or any Spanish, and the family becomes they become very self-reliant on each other and very secretive, I think in part probably because of his father's past. So he's got the immigrant zeal to succeed, that ambition, but also sort of a natural sort of secrecy that I think was tailor-made for this kind of business, right? And his partner, Ramon Fonseca, actually starts out as quite the idealist. He's a student leader. His father, his grandfather was one of the sort of founders of modern Panama in some way, and he originally wants to become a priest. Ramon Fonseca does. He falls under the sway of this sort of very charismatic, in the sense of popular and likable priest who's doing work with the poor in Panama, and then gets kidnapped and killed and murdered by the military, and Ramon goes to the he joins the UN in Switzerland, and he blames the United Nations for kind of squelching his idealism. And he comes back to Panama and sort of wants to make money and wants to sort of turn his attention to being successful in business. And so he ends up partnering up with Jürgen Moltke, and together the two become a very potent combination. And then they're willing to really push the envelope. So in the mid 1980s, Panamanian shell companies start to gain a bad reputation because of Noriega and because there's a lot of sort of drug trafficking going on around the Panamanian financial system. So they go to the British Virgin Islands, which has just passed a company incorporation law that is actually modeled on the Delaware incorporation law. And they're one of the first people to popularize the British Virgin Islands. And other people follow them after that. But the British Virgin Islands becomes such a big player in this secrecy world that in China, for a long time, they refer to anonymous shell companies not as anonymous shell companies, but as BVIs, short for the British Virgin Islands, because everyone uses, companies from the BVI. So, I mean, these guys were innovators, but, ultimately the business model that they created could not keep up with the changing reality. I mean, I asked Jürgen Moltke at one point if he had ever seen that famous I Love Lucy episode where Lucy is in the chocolate factory trying to keep up with the conveyor belt as it's moving faster and faster. And he had, in fact, seen it. And it sort of became like that for Moltke Fonseca. Increasingly, these jurisdictions started to ask questions about the shell companies, about the people behind the shell companies that they were selling, and they couldn't answer those questions. And when they tried to find out that information, the lawyers and the bankers and the accountants for whom they had set up the companies wouldn't provide that information, and it eventually became untenable.
Can we expect any changes to come in through the governments that we put in? And I don't like to bring out politics too much, but I think it applies to this. So when we put in a president such as we have now, is he going to do anything about something like this?
Well, I mean, this president, I would say absolutely not. I found, and I have a chapter in Secrecy World about this. I found mention of at least 9 foreign business partners of Donald Trump's who are in the Panama Papers, and they're involved in all kinds of alleged bad behavior, which range from tax evasion to prostitution to bribery in West Africa. And Donald Trump himself admitted on the campaign trail that he has 515 companies, including 378 from Delaware. So he is a practiced user of this secrecy world. A lot of real estate people are, and ironically, the tax bill that was just passed in many ways incentivizes companies and individuals to use these kind of anonymous shell companies. So I think at the moment, we're actually heading in the wrong direction as far as transparency and reining in the abuses from this secrecy world.
So in a way, at the moment, current government or administration is kind of working for something like this. They're not really working against it because they're very rich themselves.
I'm afraid so. I mean, I think it's not just that there are lots of there are billionaires and mega wealthy people both in the Trump administration and in Congress, who are inclined to keep these perks open and thriving for themselves. And in fact, in the second leak, the Paradise Papers, there were political donors for both Democrats and Republicans, as well as several of Trump's cabinet members, including the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross. So yes, I mean, I think that's a big part of why they you know, they want to keep this this system in place and thriving. And then, you know, you have all these vested interests, you know, the lawyers and the secretaries of state and the bankers and all of that. I mean, it's really only going to change when people start demanding it, and they're only going to really start demanding it when they make the connection between the fact that, you know, our bridges are crumbling and our schools don't have heat. And we can't afford enough police and things like that. And they make the connection and go, hey, part of that reason is because, you know, there's this rampant tax avoidance and tax evasion that's going on, and we're not doing anything about it.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you mentioned Delaware a lot. So Delaware is really, how do you explain Delaware and what they do? How's that?
I mean, Delaware, it's been, you know, they've been doing this for a long time. And I talk about this in Secrecy World, the history of Delaware. And when they first passed their corporation law, they're actually very worried about the power of corporations. And you can't actually form a corporation in Delaware without a judge agreeing to it or an act of the legislature, you know, because they recognize that this could be a real font for abuse. And then we get to the point today where basically anyone can form a Delaware corporation for any reason and give very little information. They've come a long way. But it's just, I mean, it's a thriving business. It, you know, as I said, it brings in $1 billion a year just creating, Delaware entities. So it's they do not want to change it, and they fight it. They fight any efforts to impose transparency on them tooth and nail, and that's bipartisan. It's sort of Democrats and Republicans, and so that's, you know. But what's so fascinating, and I get into this in Secrecy World, is that the rest of the world kind of modeled what they do on Delaware. So the BDI, you know, their corporation law is sort of based on Delaware, and Panama's corporation law is based on Delaware. And then the other piece of this, if you'll allow me, because it's sort of fascinating.
Oh yeah.
And that really underscores how involved the United States is in all this, involves something called bear shares. And these are fascinating things. These are actually certificates. They're pieces of paper. And whoever physically holds the piece of paper owns the company. And governments hate this, right? Because it's sort of tailor-made for money laundering, right? If I have a company and the company has a bank account or house or whatever, and I give you, and the company is owned by a bearer share, and I give you the piece of paper, the bearer share, then you own the house. You own the bank account, right? And so it's very hard to track. You know, completely not transparent, and governments hate it, right? So they have been, you know, governments have been trying to crack down on bearer shares for a long time, and it's worked. You know, slowly but surely, countries have either forbidden bearer shares with their shell companies, or they've demanded that they be put under custodianship, which means that the piece of paper, the certificate, has to be in a safe, you know, in a lawyer's office or a banker's office, and then that lawyer or banker is responsible for knowing who is the actual owner of the company, right? So there are only two jurisdictions left in the world, really, that allow bearer shares. One is the Marshall Islands, and the other is Liberia. Now, where are the public registries of the Marshall Islands and Liberia based? Not actually in the Marshall Islands or Liberia. They're based in New York and Virginia. That's where the public registries are run out of. So it's really the United States and the United Kingdom, you know, England, that are setting the rules for the system and that are allowing it to continue to operate as it does. They are the biggest players in this secrecy world.
Well, now I'm depressed. Wow.
Well, you know, I mean, this is why people need to be aware of it, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be this way. We just have to have the imagination to want to change it and to start demanding better from our public officials.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's in desperate need. And now the two lawyers, Mosaic and Fonseca, how are What's going on with them now? I know that I heard that they had got arrested for some problem a while back. What's happened to them?
I mean, there are a number of criminal investigations swirling around them. They were arrested and detained as potential flight risks for almost 2 months, but have been released. The leak investigation kind of destroyed their law firm. So originally, at their height, they had about 600 employees and offices all over the world. And now I think it's down to about 80 employees. They can't actually just close up shop entirely because they still have all these companies out there, and you just can't turn off the lights and walk away from that. You know, you have to figure out who's behind those companies and what's going on, and respond to inquiries from governments all over the world. But they're keeping a very low profile. I think they're quite bitter in some ways. In part because they really do believe that, Panama is a small player in this, that the U.S. is the biggest player, and the U.S. has ultimately been the biggest beneficiary of their demise. The reality is that they were only one of the top four or five companies that were doing these kinds of incorporations that are on the shell companies. And there's lots of other firms that have continued to do this business. And they feel kind of like they were scapegoated in some way. But it remains to be seen whether, in fact, there will be a successful criminal prosecution against them. They, of course, claim that they did nothing illegal. It has yet to be determined, who's right on that score.
If something happens to them, what happens to all those companies that they've shelled? Like, does anything bad happen to those people that have shelled through them?
I mean, this is a great question. I talk about this a lot in my book, Secrecy World. There's a wonderful debate that I found in the Panama Papers between Mossack Fonseca and the Swiss bank UBS, where at a certain point, Mossack Fonseca approaches UBS and says, well, we're being leaned on by all these jurisdictions where we do business. We need to know more information about who's behind these shell companies that you asked us to create for you, for your clients. And the banker at UBS gets all indignant and says, well, you need to know that information. We don't. And Mossack Fonseca goes, but you asked us to create the companies. We invoiced you, and then you marked the companies up before you sold them to your clients. It's not on us. And the banker, still indignant, threatens to report them to the Swiss authorities for money laundering. And eventually they work out some kind of arrangement, where they won't really ask some questions and that sort of smooth it over. But it becomes sort of like a hot potato, right? Nobody wants to take responsibility for how these companies are being used. And that's what's made it so difficult for Mossack Fonseca today is that they're going back to these lawyers and accountants and bankers who they set these companies up for and saying, who was the real owner of these companies? And in many cases, the lawyers, bankers, and accountants are just ignoring it, because they're not the registered agent for the company, so they can kind of skate past that. But, as I said, there are this data now is in the possession of several countries, Germany in particular, and there are tax authorities that are actively looking at it and starting to really try to figure out who are behind these companies and whether they owe taxes and whether they're involved in illegal activity. But even with 11.5 million documents, it's still just one company. It's still just one small piece of this larger world.
Wow. Just amazing. Now, I was looking at some of your other books, too. I just want to mention that. Your one book called Vice. So that was kind of about the vice president for George Bush.
Yes, it was a biography of Dick Cheney that I wrote with a colleague in 2006, which was fascinating. I mean, I think Dick Cheney is actually somebody who deserves a sort of Robert Caro style treatment. You know, Robert Caro is an extraordinary journalist and biographer who's written a multi-part biography of President Johnson, and I think that Cheney deserves a similar approach. I mean, this is a guy who was the youngest chief of staff in the history of our country in the Ford administration, and then really was a major player in the U.S. government up until you know, the end of the Bush administration. And he's a fascinating, very interesting, you know, character who was involved in lots of different things. So this was just a stab at that. It was just a one volume, relatively quick biography about Dick Cheney called Vice: The Hijacking of the American Presidency.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, you know, a lot of people considered him like that shadow president, and he was certainly unpopular in the public.
I mean, he had extraordinary power, particularly in the first term of the Bush administration, Bush 2, George W. Bush. In the second term, his power started to wane a little bit. Yeah, and by the end, he had been somewhat eclipsed. But yes, I mean, he was an operator par excellence. I mean, he had been at the very highest level of the government since he was in his early 30s, and so really knew, you know, how to manipulate the levers of power in a way that I think very few politicians, American politicians, have.
Just amazing. Well, this has been incredible. I really enjoyed it. We have your books up on the website as well as your picture. What's next for Jake?
I am working on several different projects, and I look forward to being able to talk more about them in the near future. At the moment, it's a little bit too early, but they promise to be very exciting.
Yeah, secret. You better watch it. They'll be, they're watching. They're watching. They're listening, and they know everything. So, you know, I know. I see these movies.
Hopefully not everything. Well, but it is. You know, it is. I think one of the things that you know, the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers do tell us is that there are many secrets that don't stay secret forever.
Yeah, it's. I think it's true. As soon as you know, you share anything, and it doesn't take long. You know, someone's always talking. Well, it's been a pleasure. Now, the book we've been talking about is Secrecy World, and our guest is Jake Bernstein. I want to thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. I appreciate it.
Okay, welcome back. And now we're on to the conspiracy countdown of the week. And joining us is Joe Usinski, our professor in Miami. Thanks for being here, Joe.
Great to be with you this week. Thanks for having me.
Always. So what have you found out?
I'm sorry. So in trolling through the internet this week, I have our top three conspiracy theories that are making their way around. Before I start with the top three, I want to give you our number four runner-up, and that is that Amelia Earhart, some people say that she just crashed out in the ocean, and we haven't been able to fully find out what happened to her, but some people are saying this week that she was eaten by giant coconut crabs. Now, this isn't really a conspiracy theory on its own.
Yeah.
Unless the coconut crabs were somehow conspiring to eat her and hide their activities as such. But it's being called and treated a conspiracy theory. perhaps because this this knowledge might have been hidden from us. But if you see the pictures of the crabs online, you might see this as plausible, because the crabs are known to eat things as large as cats, and they're fairly large coconut crabs. So that's our runner-up for the week.
Now, is that somewhere near Russia? Are they Russian coconut crabs?
No, this is out in the Pacific, and they have a few islands where they say this may have happened. But they say she crashed, made it to an island, and either she was eaten alive by the crabs or her corpse was disposed of by these giant crabs.
Oh, well, that's good. Now we can have a crab killer, just like the pig farmer. there'll be a new one. We're giving someone the idea. There we go.
So I guess if you're ever accused of murder, just say the crabs did it, and then that's your get out of jail card.
Yeah, the crabs did it, just like Amelia. That's how I learned it.
All right, so for our number three, and I'm not sure this gets that much more sane, but our third most popular conspiracy theory making its rounds this week is that planet Nibiru is on a collision course with Earth and may spell doom for us in the coming months. And this has also been tied in with reports that Jupiter and Venus are going to smash in together. And if that were to happen, that would cause 14 days of darkness, they're saying. What scientists say is that if you have 8 days of darkness, that would be really bad for the planet and probably be extinction level. But with two planets in our solar system smashing, or with another planet just coming to smash into us, that would be extinction-level events. So that's our number three for the week.
Jeez, we have 8 days of darkness in Seattle all the time.
Yeah. I mean, you've seen what happens with 30 days of night.
the vampires come out in Alaska. Never know.
Oh, great.
And going back to the crabs, I mean, I'm still here, and I had crabs once.
I think that's a very different kind of crab, and the size of the crab might be exponentially different.
She just didn't have the same comb that I had.
Yeah. Well, she was stranded on an island.
Well, look what Gilligan was able to do on an island.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, number two.
So, number two, Roy Moore, the judge and then Senate candidate Roy Moore in Alabama, is accused of inappropriate relations of varying degrees with young women dating back decades. And the conspiracy theories surrounding this are one, are these allegations made up as some sort of plot to bring him down? And then two, there's this question of robocalls that have been made in Alabama.
Uh-oh.
Where there's a message that's being sent to people on their telephones that says something along the lines of, "Hi, my name is Bernie Bernstein from the Washington Post. If you're a woman and you have a story to tell about Judge Roy Moore, I'm happy to print it, and I won't even verify if it's true."
Oh,
so the conspiracy theory is about this, is that they are trying to, this is either somebody from the judge's campaign trying to sow the seeds of doubt about the accusations against the judge and make it look as if there's a conspiracy by the Washington Post and perhaps Jewish people to get the judge. Or, and this might be equally plausible, that somebody is planting these robocalls to make it look as if the campaign is trying to make it look as if there was a conspiracy. So we may be going down a rabbit hole with some of this stuff. But the number two of the week is the robocalls around Judge Roy Moore.
Wow. You know, it's probably Kevin.
You know, I'm off during the day. I got nothing but time to sit here and randomly call numbers in Alabama.
Yeah.
And I am a Jew.
There we go. We knew it. The Jews did
it. So here in Seattle, if you have a story about Roy Moore, please call me, and I won't even verify it. We'll say that on air.
Yeah, what they've said about these robocalls is they sound incredibly fake from the reports to not be really convincing in any way.
Well, we're not.
If you do go back in time, there have been accusations, particularly during tight campaigns, where, you know, if you go back to, I think it was South or North Carolina back in 2000 in the primary race between Bush and McCain, they say that there were some push polls put out there that insinuated that McCain might have had an interracial baby that he was hiding, and that this may have tipped the scales in favor of George W. Bush. So these calls are sometimes used to, you know, sway public opinion one way or another, oftentimes with very dirty tactics because no one's recording the telephone and no one can really track down who's making these calls.
Yeah.
So who is reporting? So who's reporting this?
So it's these phone calls are getting widely reported, so by quite a few different sources. So there's quite a few people who've received the calls, and they're all the same. So the transcript has been made available by people who've written it down, which has led to a joke on Twitter. And because this fictitious reporter's name is Bernie Bernstein, they said, you know, if you want to be part of the Jewish conspiracy, then just pick it's your first name. And then your first name again with Steen at the end. And that is your Alabama Jewish conspiracy name.
Well,
there you go. Alan Warrenstein.
Warrenstein.
Yes.
You can be Warren Warrenstein.
Yes.
Perfect.
Thompson-stein. And I was groped by Roy Moore in a broom closet.
And was it good?
Well, I mean, it was full cut. You know, it was comfortable. It was warm.
Well, onward. So what's the big one of the week?
So the number one conspiracy theory this week is the Hillary Clinton Uranium One scandal, which has been simmering for some months. But it's made a big splash this week. For two reasons. One is that Representative Louie Gohmert put out a flowchart showing all the different actors involved in the conspiracy to give preferential treatment in this particular matter, and trying to allege a whole host of nefarious characters in this uranium deal. And after that chart sort of confused people because they had essentially hundreds of connections drawn between many different actors, Sean Hannity put out a more simplified version that made some of the connections a little bit more clear, but it was essentially getting to the same idea, and that is that Hillary Clinton was involved in some shady dealings on this particular deal, and this is sort of a big conspiracy theory this week, partially because some people believe it, and partially because other people are shocked at the brazenness at which these accusations are being made, particularly by members of Congress who don't normally traffic in conspiracy theory flowcharts.
Wow. I didn't even think that mattered. I don't know. I haven't heard anything about it.
So a neat thing is that these flowcharts, because of this, have made sort of a comeback. And I don't want to say that only the Republicans are doing it. There's been one put out by the DCCC, which is the Democratic Congressional Committee, and they have put out one that involves a representative from California named Dana Rohrabacher, and it's called the RohrabacherConspiracy.com, and you can look it up. And this is from, the Democrats. And it's got essentially a flow chart, a fairly simple one, but it's got Putin tied in with some Republicans trying to insinuate some sort of Russian control over the Republican Party. But, you know, the Democrats are doing it and the Republicans are doing it too. So I guess we're stuck with these flow charts for at least a little while now.
The new trend. Hillary did it. Oh, well, that's interesting. That's great.
But the Crabs have not been accused of being involved in the Uranium One decision in any way. They are left off of that particular flowchart. So that is good.
So. Oh, yeah. Thank God for the Crabs. Only ones we can trust.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I guess that it gets the point across. Just having the conspiracy come out, it brings into doubt everything, right? So,
you know. It does, and it's created a lot of dissension, particularly at Fox News, where you have your nighttime programming saying it's true and putting out these flowcharts, and your daytime programming saying it's not true. And so viewers are getting sort of a mixed message if they watch at 3 p.m. or if they watch at 9 p.m. And then you have a lot of coverage being very negative towards this particular conspiracy theory. Now, one thing I would caution is, you know, there may or may not be something in this Uranium One deal, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't other reasons to be suspicious of the Clinton Foundation or of Hillary Clinton's dealings as Secretary of State. I'm not saying there's anything necessarily there, but it's always good to investigate these sorts of things. And that's something that's been brought up by Attorney General Jeff Sessions this past week as well.
Yeah, now, well, because he needs to do something.
Because at the base of every conspiracy, isn't there a small element of truth? So what would even get this started?
So, well, one thing I would say is that, you know, a lot of conspiracy theories, it's not necessarily about the truth of the theory itself, but we often start out with, well, here's somebody who is very powerful that we don't like, and let's accuse them of doing bad stuff. So there's a psychological element there, and that's why you wind up with people who don't like Hillary Clinton accuse her of conspiring, and people who do like her don't. Now, in terms of how good the evidence is, it's always in the eye of the beholder, because what is good evidence to you in one case might not be good evidence in another case, and what's good evidence to you might not really mean anything to me. So sometimes these things can fly with a little bit of what I would consider good evidence, and sometimes they can fly on almost nothing. I mean, I could tell you there's evidence for the reptilian elite theory, right? I mean,
well, true.
If you say there's interdimensional lizards that rule the planet, I could say, well, our planet exists, and theoretical physics suggests that other dimensions exist, and lizards exist. Well, now we have some kernel of truth. Now, how far does that really get us? Not that far in that instance, but there's something there, obviously, right? But you want to get more and more and more before you settle on the explanation, I think.
Well, so I'm speechless.
So we got crabs, lizards.
Yes, I mean, it all
lizards
fits.
Got crabs.
It all no, the reptiles, they don't have hair.
But that's a strange thing. They're Jewish reptiles. They
now, I know the reptilians exist because they're supposed to be the ruling family, but then that leads us to England. So that's a whole other conspiracy theory. I think that a reptilian member of the royal family was Jack the Ripper.
Okay.
Well, if you go to London and you take the tours, they won't normally say that. They have a whole host of characters that many researchers have pointed out. For a few years, they were saying it was a Polish immigrant, which I found very offensive. And then they did some DNA testing, and they were actually able to rule that one out.
Oh, so. Right. Right. I remember that. Yeah, because there was some... wasn't there some semen or something left on the Catherine Eddowes?
They had something that they were able to test, and then they were able to trace it back as best they could.
Yeah.
The blue dress.
Yeah. Well, Joe, thanks very much.
So thank you, and I'll be back with you next week.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.